Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, and happy 4th of July. It is fascinating that here we are once again in the middle of the summer, celebrating Independence Day all over again. It comes every year, and it is the birthday of the nation as we celebrate it. It's fascinating to think about the fact that we do celebrate Independence Day as the 4th of July. That's our national holiday. That has become such a potent symbol, recognized not only in the United States, but around the world. If you say the 4th of July and many other parts of the world, they're going to know immediately what you're talking about. Why? It is because the announcement made on that day, on July the 4th, 1776, changed world history and shapes world history even now. It's fascinating also to think about the fact that the nation's birthday, the 4th of July, is actually not the day when the Declaration of Independence was signed. That came the day before, on the 3rd of July. So why do we not celebrate July the 3rd as our Independence Day? Well, it's because the announcement was made on the 4th, and all of the documents related to the announcement were dated the 4th of July, and that's the date that really has stuck in the nation's consciousness. That is the date that just seems right for the anniversary of our national independence. Those who signed that historic statement of liberty were putting their lives on the line. Study after study in terms of an historical approach goes back and looks at every one of those individuals who signed the Declaration of Independence. Many of them lost everything. Some of them lost their lives. Many of them lost their property. They all knew when they signed the Declaration of Independence on July the 3rd, 1776, that they were putting their lives on their line. They referred to it as their lives, their liberty, and their sacred honor. And they put all of that on the line because they believed that America must be a nation. You know, when you start looking at all of this, you recognize that going back to 1776, we don't go back to the start of the Revolutionary War or the War of Independence after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The war had begun the year before. So we were already in armed combat with Great Britain. Historians in Great Britain refer to that period before the Declaration of Independence as a civil war or an insurrection. But beginning on July the 4th, 1776, in terms of a public announcement, those men who signed that document were, in the eyes of the British, committing treason. But in the eyes of the new nation they had just declared, they were considered patriots. You know, it's important for us to go back to 1776, even as we look from the vantage point of 2008, and remember that the Declaration of Independence wasn't just a fact of nature. It didn't have to happen. It was an unusual moment at an unusual time, a radical statement that was stating some things in the Declaration of Independence that had never been so stated before. For instance, the statements about individual liberty and the rights of representation. You remember the cry of the colonists was no taxation without representation. The cry for a legitimate representative government was what was behind the Declaration of Independence. But there was more. There was the sense that the colonies had developed a sense of national identity. There was a very clear understanding that the 13 colonies that bounded themselves together and bound themselves together in terms of the sacred covenant of the Declaration of Independence were actually now a nation. They were declaring what they believed to be a fact, but it was a fact that would have to be won on the field of battle. And it was. It was an argument, however, that had to be won in the court of public opinion. And as we look back in terms of an historical perspective, it was, and it has been, as has been made necessary again and again, as each generation has to make the cause of liberty its own. You know, when you start looking at this argument, let's realize how radical it is. Into the world of the late 18th century came the Declaration of Independence. And the fact is that at that moment, every single human being on the planet was ruled by some kind of monarchical or autocratic government. There was no representative democracy on the face of the earth. Now, when it comes to Great Britain, there was something of a representative democracy in terms of the evolution of parliament, in terms of the limitation upon the monarch, but there was nothing like what America was proposing to be. There was no government like America was proposing to form. And yet, even as we make the mistake sometimes of thinking that the Independence War or the Revolutionary War began after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, we sometimes think that the representative form of government we know today came immediately after. That wasn't true either. the ratification of the U.S. Constitution was to come almost 15 years after the Declaration of Independence. It would not be until 1789 that we would have the Constitution that would establish the representative government that we recognize today. Between 1776 and 1789, America was ruled by representatives through the Articles of the Confederacy. That was the beginning, the embryonic stage of American representative development, its political evolution that produced what became our representative government we know today. So even as we celebrate the 4th of July and the Declaration of Independence, we need to recognize that that declaration was a down payment on something that had to come later. As we recognize something that is perhaps even more noteworthy, we would look at the fact that the American Constitution is the longest surviving constitutional form of government ever known in human history. Well, we put all that together in the 4th of July, 2008, and of course we find ourselves in the middle of a presidential campaign, the very kind of campaign that draws our attention to our form of government, to the role of the nation's chief executive, to the role of the presidency within the country, to the importance of citizen involvement, to the urgency of citizens being rightly informed about the issues and voting by conscience and principle when it comes to a national election. There are so many issues that are swirling about the 2008 campaign that could not have been considered when the nation declared its independence in 1776. You know, as a matter of fact, when you look back to those Americans, they began to call themselves that. Those colonists become Americans back in the late 18th century. They could not imagine America as a continental nation. There was no from sea to shining sea. It was just 13 barely surviving colonies there on the edge of the Atlantic. Now America is a continental nation, stretching from the Pacific to the Atlantic, but it has only been in the 20th century, and indeed in the second half of the 20th century, that America became the major player on the world scene. This generation of Americans sometimes believes that we can just skip from 1776 to 2008, assuming that America has always really mattered in terms of the world picture. And amazingly enough, it has, but not always militarily, not always economically, always politically. Because what was ensconced within the Declaration of Independence in 1776 was a set of ideas that has taken hold in much of the world. Every year, there is a map that is published of the world in terms of freedom. The different nations of the world are colored according to their various forms of government. There is no doubt that representative democracy has been spreading radically throughout the world, especially in the last half of the 20th century. Governments that had been autocratic, monarchical, dictatorial, they've been giving way to something like a representative democracy. Yet, even as we take confidence in the fact that this American experiment is spreading around the world, we also need to be chastened by the reality that it is often reversible. Take, for example, the country of Russia. Look at the Russian government that had been more democratic 10 years ago than it is now. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russian people cried for a representative democracy, but they have been going backwards in terms of a more autocratic form of government. We look at that and we say it can't happen here. Well, there are checks and balances. There are reasons to believe that Americans are vigilant about the cause of liberty. But on the other hand, complacency is the enemy of the kind of courageous liberty that was exhibited on July the 4th of 1776. So as you and your family are celebrating the 4th of July, Independence Day, I hope you're enjoying a good picnic. I hope you're out with fellow citizens enjoying the fireworks. I hope you are celebrating this day not just as a day off, but as a day of celebration. But I hope in some way you and your family will also take account of the fact that the argument that is found so preciously, so powerfully within the Declaration of Independence is an argument that has to be defended even now. We look back at the courage and the sacrifice required of that generation, and we understand that they were literally putting their lives on the line. You know, to defend the Declaration of Independence today, you do not risk being called a traitor. However, you do risk, by failing to continue this argument, that we will lose what was gained with so great a price in 1776 and beyond. You know, as we celebrate the 4th of July, it's very interesting to note that America in 2008 is such a different nation. You're listening to radio, something that the founders could hardly have imagined. But you do know the heart and soul of this nation, something the founders of this country longed for, hoped for, gave their lives for. Happy 4th of July. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the topic of what we should be looking for in a presidential candidate. An awful lot of the language out there suggests that we should be looking for someone who's going to change the world, maybe even stop the oceans from rising. Then again, as they say, maybe not. This is a classic conversation. It's one of those conversations that citizens need to have. No better time to have it than the 4th of July. We'll be right back with more on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The question is, what exactly are you expecting from a presidential candidate? No, from a president. Let's assume that your candidate is elected. What exactly are you hoping for? The background to this question is something I heard that is absolutely amazing. And I don't know if you heard this as well. It was earlier this week. It was on Tuesday night when Barack Obama had this to say.
I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs for the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. This was the moment when we ended a war and secured our nation and restored our image as the last best hope on earth. This was the moment. This was the time when we came together to remake this great nation so that it may always reflect our very best selves and our highest ideals. Thank you, Minnesota. God bless you.
That was Illinois Senator Barack Obama, and it was on the night where he effectively claimed the Democratic presidential nomination, and it was the night in which he gave himself to some of the most soaring political rhetoric heard, I would argue, in modern decades. Now, one obvious fact comes to the fore, and that is this is an outstanding public speaker. His ability to use his voice and to use the English language to effect has not been matched, I would argue, by a presidential candidate to probably since 1980, with the rise of Governor Ronald Reagan running for the office of President of the United States. But I also was struck by one line in particular out of this where I had never heard, in all my days of listening to politicians, I had never heard anyone say what Barack Obama said on Tuesday night when he said, "This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal." Now, with all due respect, I just can't imagine that anyone's going to look back to June the 3rd of 2008 and say, yes, that was the moment when the planet began to heal. Just what do we expect from a president? I'll be very honest with you. I don't think that a president can make the oceans rise or fall or heal the planet. I think this is not only soaring political rhetoric, I think it leads us to the question of whether we have any kind of rational conception of what the office of the President of the United States is all about. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jerry is listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. There's many things that you can expect from a president. Obviously, there's leadership, ability to inspire people. But I think one thing, one specific issue I would say is like the economic sovereignty of the United States to support and negotiate trade deals which benefit the United States and don't have the loss of manufacturing jobs to cheap labor places like China. We're arming our enemy, China, by sending so many jobs overseas, and they're using that to spend on the Chinese military, which is a threat to us. I think that's one important issue.
Okay, Jerry, I appreciate the call. And as I'm thinking this through with you, it seems to me that one key insight from your call is the fact that a president of the United States and his administration do have a lot to do with American trade policy. you take away Bill Clinton and the first President Bush and the second President Bush, and you don't have some of the big trade agreements that frame the way we do business right now. And the president has a lot to do with that. His trade representative has a lot to do with that. Of course, these treaties eventually have to be ratified by the Senate, but Jerry's exactly right. The president has to take lead. The Senate can't take lead in a treaty or a trade agreement. It has to come from the administration. And as much as I agree with Jerry on the fact that that is a presidential power and a presidential responsibility, I think at the same time we have to recognize that the president has no constitutional authority over the global economy. In other words, things are going to happen well outside the reach of the American government, not to say the American president. So even though he does have a very key responsibility here, and I think Jerry's exactly right about the fact that that is a presidential responsibility, he draws our attention to the importance of trade. It does also point out that the president can't change the fundamentals of the global economy. He can just do and must do what is understood to be in America's best interest in the midst of that. He's not going to change the fact that there are teeming millions of people with pent-up consumer demand in China. He's not going to change the fact that labor costs are so much lower in other parts of the world. He does have to decide, or she would have to decide, you know, how this is handled in terms of formal agreements. It's good to hear from Jerry. Let's go to Harrisonburg, Virginia, where Ben's listening on XM170. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I wanted to make a quick comment about what I look for in a presidential candidate. Basically, just to say that I'm looking for a candidate who, one of the primary issues I look at is abortion, and I want to make sure that I support someone who's pro-life. But even in addition to that, I want to make sure that a candidate, you know, fights injustice and oppression and disenfranchisement, not only of, you know, unborn babies, but also of people of various walks of life, both nationally and internationally.
Ben, thanks so much for your call. It's good to hear from Virginia, and I'm with you, especially on the priority of the pro-life issue. And what I would expect from a president there is very much like what I think you're suggesting. I would expect a president to speak up for the defenseless. I would expect a president to recognize the dignity of human life. I would expect a president to issue the right kind of executive orders. The president has huge responsibility and authority through executive orders to reshape what does and doesn't happen in terms of the overall apparatus of the federal government. And so just looking back to, for instance, January of 1993, incoming President Bill Clinton, in five executive orders, undid much of what was gained in the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration for the pro-life cause. So that's a huge responsibility. I would expect the president to take the lead, and I'm going to go beyond what Ben said here in a way that I think is consistent with his argument. I would expect a president to lead in helping to develop a consensus on behalf of human life and the dignity and sanctity of human life at every level, from fertilization until natural death. That would mean policy ramifications, not only for abortion, but embryonic stem cell research using human embryos, and abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, of course. But as much as I agree that that must be a priority, and is for me the top priority, I will be very honest to say, in my voting, I also recognize that the president is limited here as well, in that he does not have the power to reach into the human heart to make a woman who wants an abortion not want that abortion. He has influence but no power. So if I had the opportunity to vote for a candidate, I would not expect that candidate to say at the moment of his nomination or apparent nomination, this is the moment where every woman in America decided she wanted the baby rather than the abortion. I would want him to say, this is the moment at which I'm going to do everything within my power to put government on the side of the defense of human life. I think the real issue here is that the president has huge executive authority, immense and perhaps even long-lasting influence. But the power to make the oceans rise and fall, or to change the human heart, that's not in the Constitution. Frankly, that's not in reality. And I'm afraid there are a lot of Americans who are hoping too much, promising too much, and expecting too much from a president. Join the conversation by calling me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK on the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. So far, in terms of callers, we've had Ben and Jerry, who sound like two liberal guys making ice cream. We've got Kelly on the line. We're going to get to her call in just a moment. You could join the conversation. The question is, what are you looking for in a presidential candidate? What are you looking for from a president? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Kelly's listening on WFIA. What do you think, Kelly?
I'm doing good. I expect for a president to give me direct answers, correct answers to issues and questions asked of him, and not to change them.
And now, Kelly, are you a mom?
Yes.
You sound like one, and I mean that as a compliment. You sound like one who would not take an evasive answer from a child. Is that right?
I taught them honesty and to tell the truth no matter what.
Well, you know, if we had a national mom to require candidates to give an honest answer, we might have a different political system, because that's often what I think of, and that's why I ask you that question. No one in any relationship would accept the kind of answers we get from many politicians. No wife would accept that kind of answer from a husband, no husband from a wife. No parent would accept that kind of answer from a child. No teacher, I say, being an educator, would accept that kind of answer from a student. But in politics, let me tell you the game that's being played, Kelly, and I'm sure you're onto this. When you take, for instance, John McCain and Barack Obama, let's put names on them. You have two men who both have a very solid constituency behind them. Both of them probably have something like 40% of the American electorate right now ready to vote for them. You can't get elected with 40%. And if they were only talking to their own 40%, they wouldn't worry about what anybody else thought. When, for instance, John McCain was asked a question about abortion or something like that, he would answer with probably a hit-the-ball-out-of-the-park kind of answer. You ask Barack Obama from his constituency, a far more liberal constituency, his 40%, if he's talking to them and to them alone, and he's asked a question, he's probably going to answer in a way that would hit the liberal ball out of the park, because he would want to nail down that 40%. The problem is you can't get elected with 40%. They both need about another 11% out of the remaining 20%. They got to persuade more than the other guy persuades out of the middle to vote for them. And so that's why the answers get very evasive. It's because that muddled middle isn't looking for a clear answer. It's looking for enough. And Kelly, when you're talking to your child and you're asking your child a question, you're not looking for just enough from your child. You want the truth. And that's the problem. The American electorate settles for what it just negotiates down to enough from a candidate. And the reality is we reward those sometimes who give evasive answers. And I'm with you, Kelly. I find that a very, very dangerous trend for our democracy. Let your yea be yea, says the scripture, and your nay be nay. You know, let's be clear. I will tell you this, Kelly. I think given the stark division between these candidates and given the issues on the table, I think we're going to get more specificity than they're going to want to give. In other words, I think the crucible of the election itself is going to force more clarity than perhaps either of these candidates may actually want trying to reach the middle. We'll be watching that together. Great comment, Kelly. I really appreciate it. What are you looking for from a president? Let's think about to what, again, Barack Obama had to say on Tuesday night, because he made some pledges, or at least implied some great achievements for his prospective administration that I'm going to tell you right up front, I don't think he's going to be able to deliver on.
I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs for the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal.
Now, that last part is what captured my attention and is why I decided this was the topic for our conversation today. That last line where he says, this is the moment. And remember, he prefaced that by saying, I'm absolutely certain that generations from now we'll be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. Now, let me tell you, let's understand that his point there was that he would bring a Barack Obama administration would bring a new focus on global warming and environmental issues, and that policy change could be tracked back to the decisions of voters to nominate him as the Democratic candidate. But to actually use language saying this is the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal, I got to tell you, that's scary stuff to me. It would be just as scary for me if it were coming from a conservative candidate. However, I think conservatives are less likely to talk that way, having a more limited understanding of government in the first place. What's your understanding? What do you expect from a president? Give me a call at 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with your calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to an interesting discussion on the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about not just the 2008 presidential race, but the big question. What do we expect from a president? What are we hoping for? Before we talk about candidates, platforms, positions, policies, what is it that we hope for just out of the presidency? The conversation is joined by calling me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Andrew's on the line calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Andrew.
I would like a president that would stop making promises that are really outside of presidential power, the power that's lined out in the Constitution.
I'm with you on that. What kind of promises worry you, Andrew?
Well, specifically the abortion issue. We talk to presidents about the abortion issue like it's really their call, and it really isn't.
Okay, play that out a minute. Whose call is it?
Well, so far it's been the courts, and they do have some sway. The presidents do have some sway over what justices they pick, but it's not a presidential mandate that will legalize or make illegal abortion.
Okay, I want to think of this through with you, Andrew. I really appreciate your call. A president's going to have to establish policies for an administration in terms of federal agencies. Questions such as what happens on federal bases, hospitals. I guess what I'm telling you is I think it's hard for them to stay out of this, regardless of whether you're pro-choice or pro-life. I think everyone's going to look to the president because the policies are going to make a difference. What would you have him to do to get out of this?
Well, I would say, honestly, make it a non-issue. I know at this point that's very unrealistic. But it's not something that the president has any direct sway over. I mean, you can say yes indirectly through policies that they support and don't support. But if we can move our dialogue more to the courts where the decision is actually being made, I think we can make more headway than just berating the president on issues that he doesn't have any say in.
Andrew, appreciate your call. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I think a lot of Americans have issue fatigue. I think Andrew probably speaks on behalf of a large number of them. And it seems at times that that these issues just come piling one upon the other. I'm going to argue, even as I listen to Andrew talk, however, that a president is going to be very hard-pressed not to be in the thick of all of that, because as the chief executive, just looking at the differentiation of powers, the chief executive has to be the one who finally answers for the government. I actually think it is a very unfortunate thing that the courts have taken up these issues and decided that it is their purview to deal with this, because I think the actual wisdom of the people in electing representatives who would make changes through law is far superior to the wisdom of an elite who increasingly reflect to themselves. You know, I do think that one responsibility of a president that I look for, that I think is much lacking in recent presidents, has been the role as a national teacher. Now, let me give you an example, a contrary example. In other words, a positive example. And this positive example I'm going to mention is a man whose policies, in many ways, I would not agree with, but whose leadership was instrumental. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt held his now famous fireside chats, he was not merely giving inspirational words. He was actually teaching the nation about the economy. He was also, in the months leading up to Pearl Harbor and America's entrance into World War II, informing and teaching America what would be demanded if war should come. He was a president who understood the teaching role of the chief executive. It's a largely symbolic role. Now, if you go all the way back to the first president, you're talking about George Washington, the teacher. He himself understood that everything he did was setting a precedent for his successors and for the stability of the American government. He also understood that he had a role to teach. Now, I think Andrew would be very pleased with President Washington in that Washington tried to stay away from divisive issues. He saw himself as really the executive over a government with the more divisive issues to be debated in the Congress. It never turned out quite the way Washington wanted it. That's why by the time he gave his farewell address after 8 years in office, he lamented the fact that these issues were going to be a part of the president's responsibility. And I guess you could say, Andrew, that from Washington until George W. Bush, we're still seeing that as the pattern. I'm going to fault this president, even though I agree with so many of his policies. Let me just give you an example. I agree with his policy on marriage and the fact that he spoke at not one, but at least two or three of his State of the Union addresses in terms of the need to protect marriage. I will fault him, as much as I appreciate that policy, I will fault him for failing to build a national consensus on this by using the authority that is his and the influence that is his to speak to it where he could teach the American people to say, look, this is why this is important. I want to speak as your president to tell you that marriage is an institution that must be protected for the good of this commonwealth, for the good of this people, for the good of this government, for the good of this society. I want to tell you of the risk of having chaos when people don't know what marriage is. I think President Bush has succeeded in many areas of policy, but I think he has just failed at the responsibility to teach on these issues. It may be that the war in Iraq and other things has simply distracted the presidential attention. But as much as I appreciate so much of what he has done, and I think, again, if you look at the marriage issue, he's been right there where he needs to be in terms of policy. You look at the pro-life issue, I think he's been right there where he needs to be, bravely where he needs to be. I think the closest he came to fulfilling this teaching role took place just a few days before 9/11 when he set down his administration's policy on human stem cell research back in September of 2001. He did an outstanding job in that national speech of teaching the nation why it was important. I wish he had gone back to it regularly. I was actually sitting in an IFB hookup for national news broadcasts in a television studio where I was waiting with so many others to hear what the president said in order that I could speak to it immediately afterward. And I was very moved by what he said. I wish we had a president, as I look to the next president, who would teach to help the American people to understand those issues. You know, when you look at the presidency, you're looking at an institution that from the very beginning was thought by some founders to be too strong and by others among the founders to be too weak. The reality is that it really does come down in many ways to who holds the office and what his ambitions are. It also has to do with whether or not he's able to build a consensus. We're looking at a very, very interesting process in the 2008 presidential race. Now that we're down to two candidates, very quickly we're going to be thick into the policies, the platforms, and the personalities of these two candidates. But the background question to all of that is what exactly we expect from a president. We're going to continue that conversation and come to some final thoughts in just a moment on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Just some closing thoughts. You know, you listen to that conversation and you think, you know, we really do have to pay attention to what these candidates are saying and what's being said about them. You know, even as we're headed now into the party conventions, and just imagine all the media attention that you're going to be listening to and seeing over the next several weeks. Just imagine the kinds of claims that are going to be made about these candidates. Pretty soon you're going to believe that the people who are nominating them in these party conventions really do believe that they're going to change the water level in the oceans, that they really are going to stop global warming, that they really are going to, just by fiat, lead to vast social changes in America. The reality is that there is no person anywhere in the world that has the constitutional authority of an elected president of the United States. But the reality is, he's still just the president of the United States. When it comes to these huge social trends, social movements, and social problems, It isn't something that is solvable by one man, certainly by one man in one term as president. It takes a nation grappling with these issues, but the nation does need leadership. And that's what we really should be looking for in a presidential candidate, someone who will bring leadership to dealing with these issues. From the right and from the left, both from Republicans and from Democrats, there are tremendous hopes that are invested in any presidential election. The American people, by and large, as polls seem to indicate, and as history seems to tell, want the nation to do well. They're looking for an individual who they believe can safely lead the nation, can genuinely be trusted, is an individual of integrity and strength and courage. Now, as you're thinking about the presidential election, let me just warn you that perhaps the candidate that makes the most overblown promises is the one who will be least likely to deliver on them. When you start looking at what some of the candidates are tempted to say, I think one of the issues I want to honor is the courage it takes to say, no president can actually do that. When it comes, for instance, to solving some of the most intractable economic issues in this global setting, the president of the United States has a role, and he should speak about what he would do with that role and how he would exercise his authority, but he cannot by fiat solve the problem. The grass will not be greener, nor the sun warmer, nor the water wetter, no matter who's elected president of the United States. The kind of language that we've heard already in this campaign that sends chills down my spine is when I hear a candidate seem to say that he's going to do these things and change the world. I do not underestimate the power of the presidency. I don't underestimate the power of one man in one place at one time committed to do the right thing. But I do believe that when it comes to these big problems, we often invest far too much hope in the role and in the person of the president. I hope you and your family have celebrated a wonderful 4th of July, and there's perhaps no better opportunity to remember the important stewardship of the vote, for we are, at the end of the day, most importantly as Americans, citizens, and citizenship comes with responsibility. So enjoy your 4th of July, have a wonderful Independence Day, and we'll meet you next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation on the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.